Michelle, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Same. I'm so happy you're here too. I appreciate you carving out some time today. It's a Friday. It's always a good day to record a podcast. But first and foremost, congratulations on the newest addition to your family.
Thank
I know it's
you.
Been a couple months, but yeah, for the people who do not know, you just recently had your third child,
I
little boy.
did. Yes, little Nicholas.
How's he been doing? You've been kind of handling that okay compared to the first two?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, third time, you're just kind of like, all right, I know what I'm doing now. I think the self-efficacy is a lot higher the third time around. And just it's, I mean, my oldest is only four, so it's easy to just kind of stick them right into the swing of things, you know, like we're already in the flow of little kids. So yeah, it's going well.
Totally. What do you think has made it easier this time around? Or have you noticed that progression even with your second compared to your first and then your third compared to your second? Like, where do you think
Yeah.
it's easier?
I think with newborns, it's such a shock just figuring out what they need because the only way that they communicate is crying, of course. And that can be overwhelming at first because you think that you're just like doing a terrible job because they're crying. And then you kind of learn like, oh, there's actually little cues that they do to signal that they're starting to get hungry before the crying starts, or that they're starting to get sleepy before the crying starts, and stuff like that. So, just kind of becoming a little investigator and learning how newborns do communicate, all the intricacies of that has been so important. I think like that is a huge learning curve with the first, but then once you figure it out, then it's like, okay, cool. Now I know how to take care of a newborn. And they end up being super easy after that. Like the hardest part of having a newborn is just if you have a toddler on top of that, because they're the hard one. So having a little babe that just has three needs, they either need to eat, they need a new diaper, or they need to sleep. Like that's worlds simpler compared to the toddler who has a million meltdowns, you know, and not to scare you. It'll be great. You'll do great with the toddler stage.
I'm just picturing like what life would be like with like a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a newborn in the house all together. And
yeah, it's fun.
Has your oldest handled that decently
Yeah,
well?
She has. Yeah, I mean, she's our girl. She's our only girl, and she's definitely a bit of a mother hen. She's very responsible. She likes to help. The only challenging part has just been that she wants, I mean, all of my kids want all of my attention. And so that's really the only thing that gets difficult or challenging with the other two is that they can't have me as much as they want. And at the same time, it's nice that she is four and she can understand things better. Like you can have conversations with a 4-year-old and explain like, you know, mommy's not able to play with you at the drop of a hat, and I need you to practice patience with that and work on things like that. So it's been good. It's been good. I mean, it's challenging, but in a good way.
I imagine with something that new too, like, yeah, being 4 years old and being able to comprehend and articulate thoughts and communicate with your parent, like it's a cool age.
Yeah.
And I imagine that it'd just be a culture shock in the house when mom's breastfeeding, or are you breastfeeding
Yeah,
or doing
I
bottle? Or,
am.
yeah.
Yeah.
So like having the youngest now spend the most time with mom and having that be, I don't know, have you noticed there's like a competition, or has that been
Every
difficult?
time I have to feed him, the older kids are like, now they want a million things and they have all these questions. So I like very quickly made it a rule. I was like, no, when mom's feeding Nikki, you guys cannot ask me for anything. Leave us alone as best as you can. I gotta focus. Like otherwise there's milk everywhere. And yeah, it's funny. Like the second my attention is drawn away or I absolutely cannot do something for them, that's when they want it.
For sure. How has that been on you as mom who, yeah, I know you work a lot with women, or predominantly with women.
Yeah.
I work with women as well. But man, being a mom is just it's a rite of passage into dismissing your needs for decades, right? And
totally.
Really putting everyone else before you. And I imagine at that young of an age, it might be even more difficult than when they're teenagers, you know, and it's like your time is finite with them to a certain extent. But like when you guys are home together as a family, it's like mom is the, you know, main supporter right now. And it's I imagine it would be very difficult for you, especially going through that for the first time. I mean, you've had two kids before, but has that been hard with the third kid this time around, or have you found it's been easier and you've been more confident in your decision making? Like how's your headspace been around everything, and how have you gotten to that point?
It's a good question. I think the mom guilt gets worse and worse the more kids you have because there's more kids to disappoint or to potentially disappoint. And that's what really I'm worried about is, well, I know that they're going to be disappointed. Like it's inevitable because I am only one person and I can't give them all the time and energy and attention that they want. And so on the one hand, I recognize the humanness and that there only so much is possible and I can be okay. Like I'm okay with that. But on the other hand, it's like I wish I could do more and I wish they didn't have to feel that way because as a parent, you hurt more than your kid hurts, you know, if you see them not doing well. And so that's where that mom guilt comes in. Like, oh, I wish you didn't have to feel this way, but also like it's life, you know, like at a point you gotta buck up and be like, okay, I'm gonna entertain myself for a little bit and I'll hang out with mom when I can. So it's just, yeah, I mean that, and that's with any lesson that your kids have to learn. It's like, ugh, I hate watching you go through the hard parts of learning lessons because I know how uncomfortable that is. Like my daughter just yesterday was crying and we had, you know, we were talking about just working through some discipline stuff. And she was like, I told her, I was like, it's okay that you're making mistakes. You're allowed to not be perfect. You're not gonna be perfect. And she's like, I wanna be perfect. And I was like, oh, I know. I get it. It would be so easy if we were. It'd be so much easier. So just, you know, walking through stuff like that and the mom guilt that comes along with wishing you could be 100% dialed in on every kid, which of course then people are like, well, that's why you should only have one kid or not have kids. And there's an argument for that too. But I'm like, you know what? My kids, if they are so sad that they can't have my full attention, I must be doing a pretty good job then,
For
you
sure.
know?
For sure.
At least that's what I tell myself.
I know. I'm just laughing at the fact that there's just so many different perspectives and stances and opinions on like what the best way to parent is, or how many kids you should have, or how you should parent your kids, or how you should present information or talk about certain things. And you know, I know a lot of people listening to this podcast right now can nod their head in agreement with you and empathize with you and have been through that experience. And they, like you said, there's other people where it's like, oh, shouldn't have had three. That's a consequence of your own actions. Like, therefore, you know, you deserve. And it's just like, man, like how do people get to that point where they think that way, or they can project, you know, their opinions onto other people that way? Yeah.
And it is a
Makes me laugh.
projection. It
Yeah.
totally is. And I think a lot of times those are the people who grew up in environments that they did feel dismissed and that sucks, you know. Like there's a natural limitation of parents where they can't be everywhere at once, but then there's also parents that are just being they're just neglecting their children and they're not locked in and that sucks. And that's I get it. I get why people have that pain and bring that into then their opinions of others, and you know, you can't fault them for that.
Totally. Yeah. And I'm kind of happy we're talking about this already, because I think a lot of what we will talk about later today will even center around our childhood and our early experiences with this stuff and what our parents did. And, you know, there's a lot of ways to talk about, you know, eating disorders and binge eating and, you know, improving your health and fitness and, you know, how to become a better person, how to become a good parent, how to not fuck your kids up, right, is really the goal that we all have at the end of the day. There's a lot of ways to do it, a lot of, you know, previous experiences, a lot of misconceptions, a lot of misinformation. It's just the water is so fucking muddy sometimes. And I think again, the idea of having these conversations, and you know, it's not to say that we know everything and this is the end all be all and this is the road you have to take, or but at least shared experience talking around the science and the rationale and the reasons behind why, you know, certain recommendations exist, I think is extremely helpful. And I'm happy you bring up the, you know, example of just like, I don't know if punishment is the right word, but just like discussing like, hey, what happened and what do we need to do different next time, if anything. And I think the communication to your child at such a young age, where it's like, hey, the goal isn't to be perfect here. You're not going to be perfect. You're not expected to do everything right all the time. I think giving them that permission, especially as mom or dad, could be so helpful and impactful, because you almost hear the opposite message as you get older, as you start to get into sports and you're being critiqued, or you're for the bodybuilders stepping on stage, or people going to school and you're getting graded for fucking every single thing you do, and how much volunteer do you have, and what is your GPA, and what experience do you have? And it's like, it's no shit. All of these things are exacerbated. So if that doesn't start at a young age of like knowing that it's okay, that we don't have to be perfect all the time, it's almost like maybe that can help save us some time and frustration and pain in the future.
I
But
hope so.
yeah, you never know if it's going to be, again, a perfect, a happy story. It probably won't. And at least we can give our kids the best chance,
Yeah, it's I think about this all the time, like what little seeds am I planting right now? And well, I'm planting a lot of seeds, but which of them are actually going to produce fruit? I'm so interested and I cannot wait to see them in their like teenage years and in their 20s and stuff, and seeing what do they remember mom saying or dad saying, because I guarantee it's not going to be the things that I think they're going to remember or that I hope they remember. I actually just last year for both of my parents' birthdays, because I've been thinking about that a lot, I was like, my parents are probably wondering the same thing. They're wondering what lessons stuck with my children. And so I did like a list of 10 things I learned from mom and then 10 things I learned from dad, and they got a kick out of it. They loved it. And it was cool to reflect on that and be like, okay, what do I want my kids to say when they're 29, 28, about what they learned from me, it's a thinker. And it's just a reminder that like this is such a long game. And same thing with your relationship with food and your body image, like your health is a long game. And I think, not to get ahead of myself, but I think that's where a lot of things go wrong, is we forget that and we want the instant results, we want instant satisfaction. And then poor choices are made just for the sake of getting quick results. And then we crash and burn. And so it's like once you change your perspective to having the long game, like how do I want to be feeling in 20 years? And what do I want my habits to be in 20 years? And how can I start working on that now? It just makes such a difference.
Does. Yeah, it does. And this has been a long intro, but we haven't even gotten to your personal intro. But I'm curious about how everything we're talking about factors into your life. And just maybe giving the audience a little breakdown of your backstory. And I'm familiar with the disordered eating patterns and binge eating and body dysmorphia and all the stuff. Not to say everyone deals with that, but everyone can experience similar things or have their own shared experience of what that version means to them. But tell us about your experience growing up, when those things started, maybe how you got through it, how that led to you becoming an RD. It doesn't have to be an hour long snippet, but tell me about how you've gotten to where you are today, because you are beyond wise, for
Oh,
your age
thank
and
you.
season of life that you're in and what you're teaching your kids. But has it always been like that? Or I know that's not the that's not a it's a rhetorical question, but tell me
I
about
get
just
it.
your experience up until this point.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the compliment. That's very kind of you. So I grew up in as many people did, I grew up in a home that I had a great family, by the way. Like, my parents are awesome. And at the same time, there was this subliminal message, maybe not even subliminal, but just like pretty clear understanding that fat people were not to be respected, or they had faults that they needed to work out, like they needed to get on a treadmill and stop eating hamburgers. And I heard stuff like that a lot. And then, of course, just with like the media and growing up in the late 90s and early 2000s, there's just so much diet culture there. I don't really like that phrase diet culture anymore, but it's what it is. You know, it's just like skinny is better, whatever it takes. And so those things kind of like piling on and just continuing to influence my young mind to believe that if I got too big, then I would need to fix that because I wouldn't be respected or my family would be disappointed in me. And I always like, it's interesting looking back now at photos of the time when I thought I was too big because I looked like all of my friends. But I thought I was so much bigger than them. I felt like the chubby one. I felt like everybody was secretly thinking that I was too chunky or whatever. And I was never even like bullied or anything. It's just totally internalized, 100% internalized. I was making all this stuff up in my head. So then I have a dance background as well, and there's a lot of pressure to be thin, especially in ballet. Really, just the dance community in general. I think it's getting a little bit better now, but definitely not fixed by any means. So that just like compounded. And then my perfectionistic personality, which is why like seeing that in my daughter now, I'm like, oh, we gotta work on this now. Like, I don't want you to think you gotta be perfect because that gets you in a lot of trouble. And most of my clients have that tendency as well. It's what gets them into trouble is thinking they need to be perfect with food, which then triggers an all or nothing mentality because inevitably they don't get to be like, they're not perfect, right? And so then they're like, well, I already screwed up, so I might as well just go all out. And so I had that same tendency, I guess, of trying to be perfect with my diet, whatever that even means. Whatever at the time I thought was perfect, because as you know, there's a lot of bogus information out there. And then, you know, I was pretty restrictive in high school, pretty obsessive with my FitnessPal. And, you know, there's a point where I was doing like 2-a-days at the gym, dancing 4 days a week, not eating more than 1,000 calories probably. So just like pretty restrictive. You could say borderline anorexia. But it'd be atypical because I have a small frame, so I never got to that underweight status, which is a loophole that needs to be examined more, in my opinion. But anyway, so yeah, eventually that gets pretty hard to maintain. And as I went to college, you know, it's such a big life change. I moved halfway across the country, and that's a lot for a young adult to try to take in and manage. And I still try to, you know, clutch on to my restrictive ways, not as intensely though, because I was kind of starting the healing process low key. But found myself like overeating and then purging because I felt so guilty about it. And then there was like this experience in my dorm when I think it was a day after I first moved in, and there was this Costco-sized chocolate cake that my roommate's mom had gotten us. It was a really sweet gesture, just like, welcome to college, you know, good luck. And my roommates were all gone. We didn't even have like silverware yet, so I just, or plates yet, so I just got out the cake on its paper platter or cardboard thing, sat in the middle of the floor, and found myself binging on this chocolate cake, like totally out of body experience. I'd never done that before. And it was like I couldn't stop. It was so weird. And then eventually I couldn't eat anymore because I felt terrible. And I was like, what just happened? Like, I'm going to school to be a dietitian, and here I am like shoving my face in a chocolate cake. What the hell? So then there's so much guilt there, which fuels unhealthy coping mechanisms. And that can include eating more, by the way. So all that to say, I have a history of dabbling. I always say like I dabbled in all kinds of disordered eating. I've purged, I've binged, I've been too restrictive. Like, I've pretty much done it all. And always knew I wanted to work with eating disorders. And it's funny because I didn't really realize I had a problem until I was taking it eating disorders course in school. I was like, shoot, that actually kind of sounds like me. I think I need to like address this. So eventually got to a place where I'm like, okay, now I want to work with people even more with eating disorders because it's so worth it to get on the other side and to not have food on your mind 24/7 and not feel like shame and guilt and have that storm cloud following you around everywhere you go and not be hyper fixated on your body. Like, man, life is so much better. So yeah, that was probably a bit longer than it needed to be, but that's the gist.
Thank you for all that. And that's exactly what I wanted to hear because there's so many talking points we could go on any of those sentences that you just said. But I'm just sitting here thinking because I've had plenty of guests on the show who have, and no one has the same experience, right? But people that can have similar shared experiences and have different introductions to this stuff and have, different tendencies that they can kind of share with other people that have gone through the same thing. And ironically, I think that's what makes a great coach sometimes is like being able to empathize and being able to have some of those lived experiences so that you can help people who, let's be real, you wish you had when you were at that age that could have maybe
Yeah.
gotten you to a place that you felt a lot better, a lot quicker. And you
Yeah.
not having to kind of learn, quote unquote, the hard way for, years on end to get to a place where you are now. But, I'm just sitting here thinking because it's like, where does this come from? Or like, where does the act of binging, for example, come from in these behaviors? And I think everything you just said was said so eloquently, and it highlights the importance of it's not just one thing. It's not just like one input. It's not one comment. It's not one sport. It's not one experience. It's usually a summation of a lot of things that can kind of lead to this path that you start having these intrusive thoughts and body dysmorphia and start. At the end of the day, it's like, hey, I can control my nutrition, or I have the ability to, manipulate how much or what I'm eating or how I can look. And it turns into this obsession that, again, turns into usually self-destructive behaviors that can lead to unfortunate health outcomes or just like poor psychology and just this never-ending hamster wheel that people can find themselves in around food. But this whole like, yeah, where does like eating disorder, disordered eating patterns, and those two terms are not interchangeable. Of course, there's similarities and overlap, but if you look at a Venn diagram, like eating disorders and disordered eating patterns, they kind of deserve, I think, their own conversation, but there is overlap in the middle between those two. But you describing your childhood, and I know a lot of people can sit here and think, oh, yeah, my parents made comments, or my uncle made comments, or the parents that my parents were hanging out with made comments about, people or watching The Biggest Loser or The Temptation Challenge, and then you add dance culture on top of this, or insert whatever, volleyball, track, tennis, not specific just to females, males as well, because I shared similar
Right.
experiences too. But you have a very, and not to say that you have to do sports, but there is a high prevalence of these things. I'm happy you said it is maybe getting better because I feel similarly too. And I think it's because we have more of an awareness around some of this stuff, or we have some of these experiences like yourself who, we can talk about these things and talk about it openly instead of it being this taboo thing that just people struggle with on their own. But, there's so many things that can go into just playing sports or being part of groups or organizations. I'm thinking about like the Athlete A documentary, which aside from the sexual abuse and all the trauma that those like gymnasts dealt with, but there was still a lot of like body image stuff that they had to deal with at Olympic, level athletes. Same with like my wife watched the Dallas cheerleaders documentary thing, and
Oh, I
it's like
haven't seen that
every
yet.
single episode, like if you watch it, you're just going to be like, oh, it's just like it makes a visceral reaction happen in your stomach. But that still happens today as well. But I think the cameras and the acknowledgement that these things exist, in addition to social media, of course, in addition to freaking music and songs and stuff we listen to. And you mentioned like the thinness was kind of the look back in the day. Now it's like curves and BBLs and snatched waist or
Still
Olympic.
unrealistic, by
Yeah, like just all
the
these arbitrary beauty standards that just have no significance and no like practicality at the end of the day either. But There's a reason why I think so many people can kind of struggle with this stuff. And I'm happy you highlighted a lot of things that maybe contributed, because it doesn't sound like it was just one event that was like,
No.
oh, I feel shitty about myself now. And I'm just maybe not going to eat, or maybe I'm going to track my food meticulously, or maybe I'm just going to restrict and then binge. But it's just a combination of a lot of these things. And I want people to appreciate that that can look very different for every single person, every single daughter, every single son, anybody that kind of comes in contact with this stuff, which is everybody. Can happen to everybody, but it's important to be aware of it.
And that's what we call predisposing factors. There's all these little things that just kind of like I would like describe them as like the starting sticks of a fire, you know, like you're just slowly putting on more and more until finally the fire can start and the dominoes really do fall into place and something happens. You know, usually there can be all these predisposing factors and then a or like precipitation, and then what we typically see is that there is a final like straw that breaks the camel's back that kind of makes everything fall into place. So for me, one of my best friends passed away when I was 17, and looking back now, or we were both 17. Looking back now, I'm like, okay, that's actually when things got significantly worse, interestingly. And I think that was like, you know, controlling my body and leaning into that, and my obsession with nutrition was kind of a way that I was coping and trying to run from the pain of, wow, I'm so young, I've never experienced anything like this, I don't know how to handle it, et cetera. And then moving to college too. And that's usually true with the people I see, is there's been like these slow things that have built up and that have piled on that just make somebody more vulnerable to turning to that point and getting to that point of using controlling food and trying to change their body as a coping mechanism. And then there can be like a big event that like just really sets it all in motion. Like actually one something I see a lot is sexual abuse and trauma there. Somebody's been aware that there's pressures to look a certain way, and then they experience sexual abuse. So then they start to cope through food, especially with women that struggle with binge eating. A lot of times this is usually subconscious. Like they're not necessarily aware that this is what's happening, but it's a form of self-protection that they're trying to make themselves look less attractive so that they're safer. And that's an example again of like things that have been building up, like beliefs that have been put in place that certain bodies are more attractive versus less attractive. Now I have a reason to pursue one of those. And anyway, it's fascinating, all of the psychology that goes into disordered eating and the environmental factors. I can't get enough of it.
Yeah, totally. And I'm really, again, happy you bring that point up of like, there's usually an event or something that forces you to acknowledge the truths that are, kind of in front of you, and you've kind of been blind to them or refusing to acknowledge that they might exist in the first place. And I've had a lot of endurance athletes and, people who have struggled with like disordered eating patterns, and their straw that breaks is like, I sucked ass in my training, or I couldn't recover, or I broke my hip, right? Or like, I was regressing in my lifts, or I didn't have my period for 6 months, or, I started to see all these things change, and I got blood work done, and my iron was incredibly low. And then you realize you're like, yeah, maybe I'm not actually healthy, because a lot of times these behaviors, these things that we're doing, kind of have a mask on of like health promoting behaviors, or we think that they are healthy, right? Or we've heard that they are what we should be doing to achieve better health. And again, that's the hard part about these kind of psychological disorders, which really what eating disorders are, is like there's a lack of acknowledgement, or there's not, there's just an inability to see what these things might truly be. And I think the hard part about it is like understanding whether or not these things are actually productive or destructive for our bodies sometimes. And one thing that you posted a while ago that I really, really enjoyed reading and saved, I remember, is like how to spot disordered eating patterns or habits or thoughts and kind of what to do about it. Because I think the question right now is like, is the answer to just let people fuck up enough to they do, break a leg, or they do have, a difficult time trying to conceive, or they do have these really tragic, tragic kind of like experiences happen for them to come back on the other side of balance and to appreciate that that wasn't a good path for them. But I know there's a lot of people listening to this that, ideally we want to prevent that from happening. And maybe not everyone's going to go to that extreme, but like, how can we sit here and help people appreciate the fact that not every quote unquote health promoting behavior could always be healthy or always be done in the best headspace? And how can we acknowledge or differentiate, like, what it means to be healthy? Because I think that's what can be kind of confusing to people, is just thinking we need to do every health promoting behavior in every instance, every single day, and that's what leads to optimal health. And you and I both know that that's not practical, nor is it realistic, nor is it even necessary. So how do we go about like helping people acknowledge what is disordered, what's not, and like how can we start to change that before something tragic even happens to them?
Yes, such a good thing or a place to go. I love this. So good. I think intent is so important to pay attention to, because two people can be tracking calories and have vastly different experiences and outcomes. If person A is, let's say that there's somebody who, like, let me just kind of pull from professional experience. A few years ago, I had a client that he had a landscaping business. He was a minority in the city, so like English was a second language, and he didn't have a lot of education around nutrition. And he was just kind of like head in the dirt, like, literally, I'm working all the time, not thinking about nutrition or how to care for my body. And then eventually he got, I'm trying to remember. The details are a little bit fuzzy now. I believe he got a diabetes diagnosis, or maybe just insulin resistance. So then his doctor referred him to a dietitian, and that's when he came to see me. And it was like, for the first time ever, he was thinking about nutrition. And for somebody like that, it can be really helpful to track calories, because you're just getting an idea of what I'm consuming and what it's providing me. And then you can learn to like leverage it to work for you and be helpful for you. But then maybe person B is an athlete and they're feeling pressures to look a certain way, and they haven't been educated well about how nutrition can be used to their advantage to perform better, and they need to be eating enough. And so instead, they're just focused on tracking calories for the sake of, I want to try and look better and have more respect for my peers, or look good in the photos that are taken when I'm at my meet or whatever it is. And tracking calories for them is pretty self-destructive, and it's going to lead to underfueling and ultimately fueling this disordered view of food, which is that I need to avoid it as much as possible. So I'm going to keep track of everything to see how much I've successfully avoided it. Same action of tracking calories, two totally different intentions and results, right? Like for person A, now that guy has a good understanding of what he's eating. Maybe he's going to understand what better choices are for him to help prevent any additional weight gain or worsening of the insulin resistance or whatever it is. And then person B is probably going to end up with stress fractures and female athlete triad if it's a female, like all these things. So it's so like, I absolutely hate the people online, and you've probably seen them, Luke, who are like, calorie counting is always a diet. It's automatically disordered. Like, no, you are living in another world right now, my friend. That is not how this works. Like, are you kidding me? Do you even know how humans work? It's just not everybody has an eating disorder or is prone to an eating disorder. Like, there's so much room for nuance here, and that's where we need to dig deeper. And we can't get lazy with just being like, oh, this is wrong, this is right. You have to look at intent and what's right for that person and their current season of life, their current headspace, and their current goals, because those change too in one person's life. It could be disordered for them at a certain phase and then not in another phase of their life, depending on their growth and everything. So yeah, I could go on and on about that, but I'll take a break here in case you have any follow-up thoughts.
Yeah, well said. I think this whole idea of like the intent in which you do things is really the biggest take-home message here, and like being really curious about where those thoughts come from, where the goals come from. It's cliche to say, but asking the why questions behind like what it is that you want and why you want those things and what you're doing about it, because that can give you a little bit of clarity as to why you're putting so much pressure on yourself to maybe do or not do some of these things that you could be doing. But I love that you use those two examples because that's so relatable, and there's so many instances where that can happen. And I have a shared experience where I've had a client. I still am working with the client. I do a workout programming. We do like some maintenance check-in stuff. But 2 years ago, when we started working together, kind of what you alluded to, maybe there was person B at one point where they got into calorie tracking and they used tracking as a means to eat as little as possible, or to try to become thinner, or to try and control how much they looked. And that was the thing that they leaned into to, fuel that kind of disordered behavior around their body and their food. And when we started working together, there was a huge, because she had gone away from tracking, and there was a reluctance, which I don't blame her for, tracking again. And that's one thing, because I love tracking. I love helping people track. But this was an instance where it's like, yeah, we don't need to fucking track, and we can talk about building a plate, and we can talk about how much we need to eat, and we talk about protein and getting into the gym and being more intentional with there. And eventually, when we did reintroduce tracking, because we got to remember again, spectrum, right? It's like we just were taking pictures, right? We're just looking at what you ate throughout the day. We weren't looking at macros. We weren't looking at calories. We weren't looking at whatever. And for this person, just reintroducing this idea of tracking in the form of just documentation of what it is in the form of a picture was really helpful. And then that led to, hey, you're eating like a fucking bird. You know that, right? Like you show me a picture and you're eating a quarter of a Go Macro bar. And I'm like, that's not okay.
No, that's yes.
And so we get to the point where it's like, okay, cool. Like, let's track. And maybe we're tracking protein, right? And she had some digestive stuff that we had to work through, but we tracked protein and fiber, no calories, didn't even look at the calories. But
Love that.
eventually she was tracking for a period of time, and we were able to come off of tracking in a positive way. And we used it to just make more informed and better decisions and get her to a place where she could do this indefinitely without feeling like she had to be overly neurotic with everything that she put into her body. And here she is today. She doesn't weigh herself. She doesn't track. She trains really hard. And that's not the goal for everybody, but getting people into a place where they can do things that aren't like just like running a rat race in their brain all the time. It's like, that's what I think most of us want for people. And again, there's so many ways along the way that could kind of fuck you up, that can make it more difficult to get to that place, but it still is a possible destination. And again, it just looks differently for everybody, but the intent in which you do these things is probably the biggest thing that can determine your success long term, or the likelihood that you can stick with a lot of the habits, behaviors, and just positive mindsets that you develop along the way.
Absolutely. And that just shows how good of a coach you are to meet her where she's at and be like, okay, like we're not going to do that. We're not going to stress about that. Let's find a way to still be sure you're eating enough or get at least a baseline understanding of how much you're eating without it triggering any discomfort, I guess, or resistance to the process, and then building on that. And I love that you brought up like through doing that, you guys discovered she was not eating enough. I think that's something that I had a friend who she struggled a lot with, like restrictive binge cycle. CrossFit super intense for that in that for a while, and we were talking, and she was like struggling with binge eating, and she was like, I feel like there's so much negativity around tracking calories now from like the anti-diet space that I feel like I shouldn't. But I'm also concerned that I'm not eating enough. So actually, when I track calories, it helps me make sure I'm eating enough. I'm like, yeah, that's a great example of why you cannot listen to the extremist point of views always. Sometimes, I guess it's helpful depending on the person. But for her, it's like, yeah, that's actually a really helpful tool for you to be sure you're eating enough. That doesn't mean you're dieting or that you're doing the wrong thing. Like, it's not always that simple. And for her, that was a helpful tool.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, as I sit here and we're talking about this, I just ideally the earlier the better that we can address these things is great. But man, as you know, like we get 50, 60 year olds come through the door and they're still struggling with the stuff that they were dealing with as teenagers, right? Or these things have perpetuated throughout their lifespan. And maybe have been passed down to their kids or, you know, people around them or whatever their situation might be. And again, it's at no fault to the parents, right? Like I remember when you were talking about your childhood, like you had a great childhood, so did I, but like nobody's parents are perfect. And like you pick up on habits and tendencies that maybe your parents did that they didn't really have figured out or they didn't know was quote unquote helpful or destructive. So we have to remember that there's like, it's never too late to start to focus on some of this stuff. How, when we add the caveat here of people who want to become parents, right? Especially, you know, girls who want to become mothers. And we've seen how trauma, childhood trauma, sexual trauma, you know, like instances where they were young and growing and they were working with through eating disorder stuff or body image stuff with their sports and just fielding all of this information. And then all of a sudden you have a daughter, right? Or you have a son. And a lot of times these, you know, moms who maybe have the issues that they've been struggling with, and then they have a kid, and then maybe it's difficult because they don't know how to differentiate their own stuff and how to teach their child not to think the same way. It's just it, you can tell it's a very complicated discussion, and it's very true to a lot of people. And the question I'm getting at here is like, what are some common things that you've seen in your practice, or even with yourself having your first daughter, your first kid, clients you've worked with? Like, what are some common things that you think moms, and we can just tailor it to moms now too, but moms might struggle with? Maybe if they haven't figured their own shit out, which ideally we can, great. If not, we got to work through that as you have kids, cool. But what are some things as we're kind of on this topic of like disordered eating patterns and thoughts and behaviors? What are some things that might persist as people have children that if we're not careful about, maybe could be passed on unintentionally to our children, which again, if we're having this conversation around how can we not fuck our kids up? That's my thought as we prepare for our daughter here in the next month or so. What are some things that you've seen in your practice or that you could kind of point to that maybe we can just like bring to the surface and at least build some awareness around, if any?
Well, it's interesting. I think that having kids a lot of times is that point of awareness where we now realize, oh, I actually don't want my kids to learn this thing from me. And now I'm noticing because of that, that I need to change it. And then usually those conversations too, like I hear a lot from our clients that they had a mom who pressured them to look a certain way or put them on a diet when they were 10 or whatever. And which is just flabbergasts me. It's insane to think about putting my daughter on a diet. I can't, but that was the culture then, you know, like especially 90s, 80s, everybody was on diets. Every woman was on diets. So yeah, again, like your parents think they're doing what's best, usually. Anyway, so they look back on that experience. They're like, wow, that really messed me up. I do not want my daughter to learn to hate her body like I did from my mom, or to feel like she always has to be on a diet, or she's not allowed to enjoy birthday cake at her own birthday like I did, like I learned from my mom. So I think that awareness is so crucial to dig into your own story and identify what beliefs someone is holding about their own relationship with food and their own body. Usually, when it comes to your relationship with food, it's tied back to how you actually feel about your body because that's what's influencing you thinking differently about food. Because we usually want to like change our bodies, right, and make them look different. So then we use food as a way to do that. And so like that body image work is so important. I think it gets missed so much because we just don't really see the connection there or see that how we feel about ourselves, how we perceive ourselves is influencing the actions we take around food and the way that we think about food and the way that we talk about food, and talk about ourselves. And so yeah, like that's going to be huge for any parent is just examining their own story, examining their own beliefs, their own thoughts around food and their body, and being okay with being uncomfortable in that and like pressing into it because there's probably going to be some stuff that comes up that's not very fun to work through, but that's life.
Life.
And yeah, it ultimately is like the best thing to do for your kids, which actually tying back to what you said about it earlier about how easy it is for moms to put everybody's needs before their own. It's this like interesting paradox that I see working with moms where they don't take care of themselves until they see that it is affecting their kids. So then they're like, okay, taking care of myself is going to take care of my kids. And even some are still like, I don't want to take care of myself because I need to take care of my kids. And it's like, no. They're this like the same though. Like you are helping care for your children or your child, especially like daughters, if you're not to say that men don't struggle with body image too, but as we know, women are much more subjected to pressures to look a certain way that's unachievable. It's so important that women dig into that, and that is actually putting their children first in a way. Like it's this, once I see that click for moms, like, oh wait, I'm actually not putting myself first if I'm putting myself first because it's still helping my kids, so I'm still putting them first. However you got to justify it in your mind, I don't care, but we got to take care of you. And you know, you always hear the cliche phrase about putting the oxygen mask on yourself before helping somebody else. It's literally the same thing. Like, how are you supposed to help your child have a healthy relationship with food in their body if you don't?
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but I think as a coach or as a health practitioner, like seeing that flip switch in someone's brain where it's like, yeah, you know what, this is bigger than myself at this point. And, you know, the motivation to do something becomes so much stronger that the likelihood of them succeeding becomes higher and their success rates compound a hell of a lot quicker, you know, when they have that buy-in,
Oh,
again,
yeah.
stemming from things other than how can I fit into a size, whatever jeans that I used to fit in when I was in college. Like those
Right.
are the motivations that some people are drawing on. It's like, no shit, that is transient and no shit, that's always fleeting. And so when you have this idea, and it's funny you bring that up because that's what I was thinking too, is like, ironically, the impetus for a lot of people to change their shit is like trying to conceive, having a child, realizing that they cannot do what they want to do with their children as they continue to grow up. Or being able to live long enough for their kids, for their grandkids, insert whatever. The motivations that we have later on in life, I think, are far more powerful than just vanity-driven stuff. And again, that's just kind of the transition that most of us will experience at one point or another. But the sooner we can start to appreciate that, again, the other side of that is a lot better, in my opinion, and a lot more productive and a lot more healthy for people to be in long term, instead of just only having these like physique-driven kind of changes and stuff, and thinking that them being in a smaller body is going to be the thing that equates to them being a happier person, where we know time and time again that that just doesn't really play out. And I'm happy, you know, we've kind of talked around this. I think you have your master's in not public health, in
Health psychology.
psychology. Yeah. Which I've been a huge advocate ever since I started this podcast of like recommending therapy to
Yes. Oh
my
my gosh,
listeners,
yes.
also my clients. Again, this is stuff that, you know, maybe there's a fine line of what dietitians and what your personal trainer, you know, God forbid if you're talking about this, just your normal gym rat guy, but just your dietitian, like there's a scope of practice that we have to stay in. And a lot of this stuff can bleed into, you know, a space where you need a, you know, a therapist that you can discuss all of these things with. And I love when you brought up that activity you did earlier of like listing out the things that you learned from your mom or your dad or your caregivers or whoever of like what you appreciated. 'Cause usually for a lot of people who go to therapy, the list is the opposite of like a mile long things of mom or dad or coach or sister or brother or friends or sorority sister or whatever it did that I need to unlearn. When in reality, like there is still a lot of good things, but it's acknowledging all of these things that exist. And again, that's when you can get just a little bit more clarity and just have a little bit more sense of direction again of what's really important to you, and having that be kind of this North Star instead of these arbitrary set of rules or beauty guidelines and stuff that we think we kind of need to uphold to be loved and appreciated for, you know, kind of who we are.
Yeah, and what you're describing there is the difference between an internal or an intrinsic motivation and an extrinsic. Extrinsic would be trying to fit into the genes from college that you had, or losing 10 pounds by a certain date because you're going to a wedding and you want your ex-boyfriend to see you looking good, whatever. Those are all external things, and they're so much more easily broken and they peter out and it's not sustainable, you know, because that motivation is going to wane pretty easily, or it's not strong enough to stick around even on the hard days when you're not feeling motivated. But the internal, the intrinsic ones of, I want to be able to run and play with my kids. I want to be around to see my grandkids. I want to set a good example for my kids. Like, and I'm trying to think of examples that don't have to do with kids because I know there's obviously people that, like, not everybody does. I want to be able to excel in my career. I want to be able to get to the next spot on the career ladder. And I can't if I'm constantly thinking about food or too exhausted to focus at work, or I want to be able to run a marathon because that's what my brother's dying wish was. I don't know. That's a very extreme example, but there's so many things that we can pull from that are more internal, and those are so much more powerful. And even on a day where you're feeling low motivation and you're not feeling excited to engage in that health promoting behavior you're working on, you can remember, oh, but why am I doing this? I'm doing this because I want to be able to run and play with my daughter, or I want to be able to run the marathon or whatever. Not because I'm trying to fit into a certain pair of jeans. Like, that's just like, I'll work on it later. But then there's like this extra weight of importance when it's something more internal. So I think that's like one of the biggest things that we can do for our clients is helping them identify, and anybody listening to this podcast, like, take some time to think through, if you have a goal, why is that your goal? And what is that going to do for you? And if it's something more on the, I don't want to say shallow, but just like on the external side where it's more about other people's opinions of you, how can we flip that into being more about your own opinion of yourself, or how you want to feel, or how you want the next 10 years to look in your life? So it's way more powerful.
Yeah, totally. And I don't think saying service level is inappropriate there at all, because I do think a lot of it is and can be. I think it's a lot of it is just like subconscious thoughts and
Yes,
the
it
things that
is.
we've believed and just stuff that old reliable. We're just going to think this way because it's an easy thing to think about. And we're just going to default to that. And the last thing I want to ask you about, talk about here while I have you, while we're speaking of extrinsic motivation and while we're speaking about mothers, is this whole kind of like, and at least for me, is where I've seen this be exacerbated more than anything, sometimes in women's lives, is this thought or this belief that you need to get back down to your pre-pregnancy weight after you have a child, or getting back to being a hot mom as soon as possible is like the thing that is most important to you. And again, I even as I say that out loud, I know a lot of people can hear that statement and be like, I know that's not true. And I know when I hear that, it's something that maybe I know the importance of taking care of my baby and eating enough and getting enough nutrients, but there's still that thought in the back of your mind of like, how quickly can I get through this so I can get back to that next step? And I don't think it's a unique thing to any one person. I think it's just kind of this culture and society that we live in, the expectations that we have, and everyone just feeds off each other when it comes to it. But have you personally experienced that at all? And as we have our female listeners, even our male listeners today too, people who might be struggling or thinking about that, or again, subconsciously having that in the back of their mind as a goal that they want to pursue in the near future, let's be real, like pregnancy can be fucking tough, right? And you see the
Yes,
body change and it's brutal.
it is.
And you're not yourself for 2 years. Like, how can we
Yeah.
conceptualize like still having vanity driven goals, but also appreciating all the other shit that we talked about today that we're saying is still super important. But I'm just curious about your experience with that, or if you've worked with women who kind of go through that, and kind of what are some things you might tell or talk about around those kind of topics? Because it can be a sensitive one.
It can be, and you're right, there's so much pressure to bounce back, but there's coexisting this reality or this awareness that that's an unrealistic expectation to have on women's, but that doesn't make this subconscious desire to bounce back quickly go away necessarily. And I personally do notice that in myself with each kid. There's this, highly logical part of me that's like, I actually really just need to take care of myself, be okay with rest, be okay with the fact that I'm not going to be at my same level of functioning that I was before I ever got pregnant, et cetera. But man, I wouldn't it be cool if I could just so quickly go back to my body that I had before? And part of that too is just like, I think just a true desire to just feel like yourself again. Like, I'm so tired of not like recognizing myself or not being able to wear my favorite pair of jeans, and I don't really want to buy another pair because that's expensive, or I'm not going to be able to fit in them in 2 months anyway. There can just be this impatience with the practicality of your body changing. But there's still, of course, this side to, I think, every woman after giving birth. It's like, wouldn't it be nice to have validation, I guess, about looking great after having a baby? And I get like uncomfortable when people, if they do compliment me after having a baby, because I'm like, I don't know how I feel about that. Like, I don't really want you to encourage me to care about how I look. But I also know that you're like coming from a good place, and you're trying to be like supportive and everything and encouraging. So I appreciate that. But I think it's important for women to know that if you do struggle with your body image, even if you get to a healed place, like I would say I'm in a healed place with my body image. It's obviously always a work in progress, but those thoughts don't go away. It's just your ability to manage them and respond to them is what changes, and you can prevent spirals because of that. So then that, in my opinion, that's what healed looks like. And I think that's kind of like recovery in most circles. That's how people would describe it. It's not that you don't ever have thoughts of the disordered behavior, or you don't ever have a bad body image day, or you don't ever wish that your body looked different, but it's just your response to that changes and is more adaptive than maladaptive or unhealthy. And anyway, that's something that has been interesting to see in my own story, because I think if I had never worked on my body image or my relationship with food before having kids, I'd probably have a really hard time with how my body changed and changes and continues to change. But I'm really glad that I did that work, because I have this like just understanding that like this is just a body at the end of the day. Like, in 20 years it's gonna look completely different. 20 years after that, it's gonna look completely different. Like, I'm not gonna be here forever. So there's just so many more important things to focus on. I'd rather just take care of my health and make sure that I am getting the most out of this life while I'm here. So that, and again, like that goes back to intent. Why are you taking care of your body? Is it because you want to be around for a while, or is it because you just care about the way you look? One of those is super fulfilling and sustainable, the other is not. So it's yeah, it's a journey for sure. And I actually have a client right now that we've been talking about. This is before she's ever, like, she is not trying to get pregnant yet, but that's a goal in the future. And because of all of this chatter about how women's bodies change and what to expect and all of that, she's like terrified that when she has a child, she's never gonna look, or she's gonna gain weight that she can't lose ever, because that's just like what she's heard over and over again. It's like, oh, your body changes, you're never gonna go back to your pre-pregnancy weight. And while that can be true for some people, and I don't think we necessarily need to be like, I don't know, disgusted by that or anything, like everybody's different. It can also be true that people end up at a lower weight than they were before pregnancy, because now they barely have time to take care of themselves. They barely have time to eat their own meals, or they're not sleeping, and so they're moving a lot more, and you know, it can go either way. They're overeating because they're having a hard time eating regularly, or they're undereating. And so I think there's just so much chatter, and I wish that people didn't have this fear around how their body is going to change. And instead, we're just like, cool, I'm going to adapt. Like, there just needs to be more resilience encouraged rather than fear.
Yeah, really well said. And I like that you finished that little segment off with that, where it's just like the fear around this stuff, I think, is sometimes the driving force around some of these, like, and I might say irrational decisions, but just extreme decision-making process that can happen with this stuff. But I think,
Yeah.
again, it's been exacerbated by this like anti-aging culture
Yes.
kind of like biohacking,
Yeah.
skincare product, not to mention like the world of filters and pharmaceutical interventions and surgical interventions. And again, these it does a lot of times come back to like beauty standards that we're constantly observing and internalizing, whether we're cognizant of that or not, like those subliminal messages that we're always being exposed to on our fucking Instagram home feed or TikTok feed or our favorite influencers or whatever movie we're watching. It's like those messages are still going to be deeply embedded with us. And I think a lot of times when people go through these really big life experiences, like having a child, you realize that, yeah, we're not, immortal, and, aging is a real thing. And the idea that, we're not going to look like we were maybe at one point when we were 18 or 21 or 30 years old, when we're 60 years old, like it could be a very scary thing. And again, that in addition to all the other confounding variables that we've talked about today, and just appreciating the fact that there's so many different inputs and everyone's experience with this is going to be different, and their starting point and their preferences and what's practical for them. So it is a very, very difficult conversation to have, or even just to give a generalized answer for that matter of fact. So I think what you said is phenomenal, but I'm sitting here as a guy who has worked with females who wedding prep or, women coming after 6 months, 9 months of, them being pregnant, having their child, and they want to get fit again or have other body composition goals. It's like, who am I to say that somebody can't want that, right? Or who am I to say that you shouldn't want that? Because what you alluded to is like getting your body back, and you know what it feels like to get or to live in a body that you enjoy being in and that you feel comfortable in. And for a lot of people, delivering and being postpartum, like you are not in a body that you feel comfortable in. So getting back to that, I think, is a reasonable goal for people to have. But again, where does that motivation come from, and what extremes are we going to go to get there, or what timelines are we putting on ourselves? And I think when we can just people can give themselves permission to chill the fuck out and realize it's not a permanent fit forever thing. Easy for me to sit here as a boy saying this, I know that, but just being able to like give yourself a little bit more grace and not have these hard timelines or cutoffs for this stuff, I almost think it can make it easier and get people to a point where they can appreciate kind of all the beautiful things that their body has gone through, because it's pretty damn remarkable.
I agree with you. I think that the problem is usually the timeline, and it's totally understandable that you would want to feel like yourself again. You would want to feel strong again, healthy again. You don't need to do that by your 6 week post-op appointment, or not post-op, but your 6 week postpartum appointment. Like we don't need to race to that point. Give yourself the permission to just be adjusting to your new life and the changes. And something I wanted to mention too before we pop off is you had touched on like the importance of therapy and how as dietitians, like our scope is limited as it should be with any profession, which I think people forget online. But
It's weird that that's a controversial thing to say this day.
I know.
Like,
Wow. How
yeah.
dare I? But yeah, like the importance of having, we have a body image therapist that I have on staff to support our clients alongside the support I do. And it's just so like body image is at some point going to require a therapist, in my opinion, because that has a lot to tie, it ties into your self-worth, it ties into personal experiences, childhood. So if you struggle with body image, like having a therapist on your side that has experience with that, because there's a lot of therapists who, like, doctors do, therapists have their specialty, dietitians have their specialty, we all have our specialties. So find somebody that's used to conversations like that and is known for that, because there's some heavy stuff that can be attached to how you view yourself and how you perceive yourself. And as dietitians, we can certainly help you with connecting those dots and That's why I got my master's in health psychology, because I want to be better at connecting those dots, but there's a limit to our scope, and anyone who relates to anything we've been talking about today, it's gold standard to have a dietitian on your side and a therapist. That's where you're going to get the most healing. And I think that's also important for anybody that is considering children or has had a child. It's going to help you heal so much more completely to have both on your side.
Agreed. Agreed. Preaching to the choir over here. Appreciate you a lot, Michelle. This was super fun, super helpful. I loved all these topics today. Tell people where they can find you and what you're up to. Are you taking on new group, client, anything right now? Just I know you said you started your podcast recently again. Just tell people where they can. I'll plug everything in the show notes, of course.
Well, if you can stand the sound of my voice, if it doesn't annoy you, everybody's different. I get it. No hard feelings. I do have my own podcast. It's called Nourished and Free. You can find it anywhere you want to find it. And then, yes, we do. We're rocking and rolling with some new clients, so feel free to reach out if you do want some support. I can give Luke the links to that, but also, like, just feel free to follow me on Instagram, and you'll be able to find that stuff too. My handle's at Yates Nutrition, and I'm technically on pretty much all the platforms, but mostly out of obligation. You're gonna see me most on Instagram, so. And my podcast. So I recommend checking me out there. But yeah, I mean, honestly, just like such an honor. You're such an awesome interviewer. You ask great questions. You're a great listener. This is like, yes, you should have a podcast. I'm glad that you have a podcast, Luke, because you're made for this.
I know it's funny. I make jokes of like, man, people need to have their podcast equipment taken away from them. And I
A
also think,
lot of people do.
yeah, maybe I should have mine too. But
No, you're great. There, I've been on shows that I
I appreciate your
don't.
comment of like, yeah, if you can stand my voice, because that was my biggest thing too. Is like, man, people are gonna fuck. I hate listening to myself, so I don't know how people are gonna sit here and do that too. This conversation was my speed. I mean this in the nicest way possible, but I felt like today we were just chatting on a beach with nowhere else to be, with like tea in our hands, just like talking about stuff that we think is really important. And I try and match the energy of a lot of the guests I have on. And there's some really high energy, which I'm sure you've had that experience too, where you're, salivating, just trying to say all the stuff that you want. But this was a really good change of pace, and I appreciate you for helping me do that. So thank you again.
Yes. Thanks for having me. Such an honor. I appreciate getting to sit down and chat with you. I agree. It felt like we were just hanging out by, I would say, a fire pit, but a beach works too.
Changeable. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Thank you again for listening to this episode. If you found value and enjoyed it, would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media. If you do, make sure you tag me so I can say thanks. Or if you're on iTunes, scrolling down and leaving a 5-star review would be much appreciated. If you ever want to get in touch with me, you can always find me on Instagram at LukeSmithRD. Thanks again for tuning in, and I hope you have an amazing rest of your day. I'll see you on the next episode.